Yes, we're back in the dark once again, and welcome to another episode of A Scott in the Dark, and this one is on communication, and it's on communication throughout the whole process of creation and installation. This is also the very first episode that I am actually doing a video for. I'm actually taping myself right now, and Gosh, that shows how old I am, doesn't it? I am recording digitally images that move and make sound.
It's just like these amazing newfangled gadgets they got these days.
Anywho, I'm doing a video as well for my YouTube channel, so you can go and watch and see how grungy I look today. The nice thing is I'm only allowing the imagery to view me from the waist up, so I may or may not be wearing pajama pants. You'll never know. Okay? But the today's episode, I want to talk a little bit about how to communicate between creatives, directors and producers, you know, the people who have the money, and how to pitch new ideas. And also, I have a great recorded interview that I did when I was at HauntCon with designer Chris Kleckner, and that will be part of today's episode. And I also want to talk about a great new book that will help you specifically with brainstorming, and it is called The Event Brainstormer, and it was written by a guy by the name of Bob Glickman, and it's a very cool book. We'll talk about that, though, at the end of the show. And you can get it anywhere, so it's pretty neat. So let's start by talking about communication in general. When you are communicating within this industry, you have to communicate with a whole bunch of different kinds of people in kind of different ways from time to time. You know, sometimes in my position, for example, I have to communicate to somebody I don't know, somebody who has a brand new project that they want me to work on. And so they give me just bits and pieces, and then I have to try to figure out, well, okay, how do I share what I can do with these people? After the project, you know, hopefully after the project is approved and I'm working on it, then I have to communicate with their designers or select designers to work with and find out who can I communicate with the best. Then I have to communicate with the other folks who are sort of on my level of the corporate hierarchy. You know, I have to find ways to communicate with the marketing people and the merchandise people and the culinary people, if those are, you know, part of the project, obviously. And then I have to be able to communicate to the cast. I have to be able to find out, how do I translate the artistic vision that has either been developed by myself or is being interpreted by me, and how do I communicate that to the frontline performers? And I've discovered over the years that it's kind of tough. You know, it's challenging because you can't talk to everybody with the same language or give them the same information. What I've found the easiest way for me is to figure out, first off, what goals are you trying to accomplish? In fact, when I do new proposals for anything, that is the first segment on the written document, and that is, you know, what are the goals of this? And maybe those goals are to terrify the most number of guests, or to entertain the most number of guests, or to earn the most money, or to make the facility the star so it can be a marketing tool for other things. All of these are valid goals. But I think you have to identify what goal you're addressing depending on who you're talking to. I know that sounds a little bit confusing, but, you know, for example, the marketing person's goal is to try to get as many people through the door as possible. The artistic director or creative director's goal is usually to create the most incredible event they possibly can, the most artistically interesting and challenging. The producer's goal, you know, the person who signs the checks, their goal may be to make the most money they possibly can. And the frontline actor's goal may be to have the most fun and scare the most people. So by identifying or at least talking about those goals and identifying those goals, you're able to figure out what words, what phrases, what things you can bring to the forefront. Now, once you've done that, I think most of my job as a communicator within the planning and the installation of an event, most of my job is to act as translator. I try to act as translator from the producer or the client to the actors, you know, to let them know that the operational side is very important to them. However, if it weren't for that operational side, they wouldn't have the opportunity to scare people and do what they want to do. So it's all about making connections of goals. It's a lot simpler than it sounds, I guess. You want to make certain that everybody understands what is important to these people and what is important to these people and what is important to you may be all different things. But I think it's really, really important to recognize what is important to each individual and be able to synergize and make connections between all of the powers that be or all of the elements within any production. Otherwise, you run the risk of being very, what I call, siloed. So it's a bunch of ivory towers operating next to each other. Another way to look at it is think of it like a shopping mall. You know, every store has its own goal, but when they work together, they create an overall shopping mall. The same is true with all of the different elements of a haunted attraction, or any performance element, really. It is a collaborative effort. So you have to make certain that the sum of the parts is greater than all of the individual parts. And that's exactly what happens in a good theatrical production. So hopefully people can understand that and make use of the idea of understand how people, what is important to other people. And that will help you choose the language and the information that you want to share with them. That's a very long sort of diatribe on the basics of communication within the industry. But I think it is the best way to start when you're trying to communicate with a bunch of different people. So if you are out there, and how can you apply all of this information? If you are out there and you happen to be a, let's say, a director of a theatrical piece or a haunted attraction or whatever, and the most important thing to you is it's your first year, and the most important thing to you is to set good groundwork so that you can continue to do this and continue to be profitable for years to come. The more you're able to find ways to communicate that to the rest of your team, the more likely it is that they'll be able to help you with it. If you are an actor and it's the first time you've ever worked in a haunted attraction, you know, you need to really listen to hear what the director, what their responsibilities and what their goals are, what they want to accomplish, and do what you can to help them accomplish them. And if you're a director, you have to listen to your actors. If you hear your actors saying, I just want to get out there and scare people, then don't bore them with the business side. But make them understand that the more successful they are at scaring people, the more successful the event will be and the happier you and the producer will be. You know, it's basically figuring out how to explain to people how multiple goals can work simultaneously to support each other and create win-win scenarios. And that's really the basics of communication up front. Now what I'd like to do is I'm going to shift to a pre-recorded interview that I did at HauntCon. And this is with a scenic designer and educator, a guy by the name of Chris Kleckner. So here's just a little bit. Well, actually, it's the whole interview. It's not a little bit. It's the whole interview that I did with Chris. And this was actually recorded on the HauntCon trade show floor. So I'm actually lucky enough to talk to Chris Kleckner, who is a designer and scenic designer, builder, production manager sort of dude, sort of all-around get things done kind of guy. And we were having a discussion, and in all honesty, we are at the HauntCon show, so this is going to be probably heard way after we recorded. But anyway, we caught up with each other at the HauntCon show, and we had this discussion about directors and creatives
talking to designers and how they don't always speak exactly the same language. And I wish I could have captured the initial conversation because we said some really intelligent things.
I think so, yeah.
Well, now hopefully we can...
It all makes sense to us.
And hopefully we can now capture that again. So you've noticed from a designer standpoint that sometimes directors and writers don't always tell you what they're looking for or how they want things done. What is the biggest challenge with that? What is the biggest stumbling block for you when that happens?
For me, it's actually listening to those words and then trying to extrapolate what they actually mean. A director has an entire vision of the entire concept of the entire production that they're working on. And designers spend all of their time strictly focusing on one aspect, and their whole world revolves one aspect. And so the level of detail from the broad strokes of a director to the fine brush of a designer is sometimes a little bit difficult to sort of transpose.
I can see that. And sometimes, as a director, it's hard to focus on all of those fine points that a designer needs to know. I'm always a big proponent of presenting the information and then allowing time to sit down with the designer to have sort of, let's ask questions, let's talk about it back and forth. Is that helpful? Is that a waste of time? What's your thought?
Oh, I think it's definitely helpful. I think that conversation eventually gets reduced as you develop a relationship with that director.
When you develop sort of a verbal shorthand?
Sure. But when you're working with someone new for the first time, especially when, because directors are very passionate about what they do, and they're very passionate about the projects that they work on and choose to work on, it's sometimes hard for them to trust that someone they've never worked before is going to approach this project with the same amount of honesty and earnestness as a director does. And I can definitely understand why they would have a hard time doing that.
Yeah, well, and the same with a designer. You know, it's one of those, you look at a designer who wants every little detail to be there and to be 100% and to be, you know, something that you may never even see in a dark haunted attraction, but you still want it there because you know it's going to be there. And so what can we do to make the conversation easier and more efficient between designers and directors? What kinds of things can directors offer designers? What kind of information can they offer designers? What kind of specific information can they offer designers to make them sparked on to do their job? Because I'm always a huge proponent of, I know what I want as a director, but I've also hired a designer for a reason. You know, they've got experience, and not just in what can be done, but what they have done in the past. I want them to bring their experience to the table as well. So I try to spark, here's what I'm looking for, but what do you think? And if that sparks something else, because I'm sure that what we come up with together is going to be much better than what either one of us would have come up with independently. So in order to get to that place, what do you think a director, or what are the kinds of things that a director can share with a designer that's going to make their jobs easier?
Well, first let me say that the approach you've just described is a fantastic outlook on a source, on a project, on a scope of what we're working on.
Have you had that not happen in the past?
Sure. You sometimes have directors who think they know exactly what they want, and they basically just want you to pull the set that they have in their head out of their head and put it on that stage for them.
So the simple answer is every designer must be psychic.
Exactly. What would be most, honestly, the easiest thing, adjectives. Adjectives, adjectives, adjectives. We may only choose four of those at the end of the day, but I've never worked on a project where I had too much research or too many adjectives to pull from. We can decide which ones are good and which ones are bad later. And I equate it to like an actor. An actor just brings things to the table. It's the director's job to eventually decide what they keep, what we lose, what we build off of. But we have to bring a pile of stuff first. And that's what I like to do. I also do some teaching, and one of the things that I have the hardest time teaching students is research, research, research. And in the 21st century, research is so much easier than it used to be. But I've never been on a project that I have too much research. I always have an idea of what I think something used to look like in the 1850s, but I need to do that research again and again and again. And every time I do, I find something different. And that something might not even be something I'll use in this project, but I put it in my pocket for some other day because it's going to become useful. And so having that open conversation and knowing that the end game of that conversation is the best story possible is critical. Because if I'm designing the best set possible, I've already failed. I want my sets to be so perfect that they go unnoticed by the audience member because they're involved in the story. And I think we sometimes lose that sense of selflessness and it becomes a competition of ideas amongst other designers. My set needs to be better than your lights or her costumes or her sound. And that's not what we're there to do. We're all there to use what we're good at to tell this story in a way that no one's heard it, seen it, or felt it before. And that's why we continue to do live art.
And now, those of you who have been listening to me for a while know exactly why I wanted to talk to Chris, because this is exactly what we've been saying. The moment he mentioned story, you know I started doing backflips. But it's funny that you mentioned this, you know, the best set in the world. One of my favorite negative critiques that happened in a theatrical piece in Chicago, the headline was, brilliant set, and then the whole article was, but the actors kept getting in the way. So clearly, the actors were not very good, but it's not about the set, it's not about the lights, it's not about the costumes, it's not about the actors, it's about all of them. And it's about how they all work together to tell the story.
Right. If it wasn't, we wouldn't call it a collaborative art.
That's right. It would be scenic design or, costumes for museums, whatever that might be. It is so collaborative and it's so important to remain collaborative. And I love your idea of not becoming a battle of my ideas are better than your ideas or my lighting is better than your set or because ultimately the audiences don't care.
Right.
The audiences want to be transported somewhere else and everything has to work together seamlessly so that can happen. And the more, you know, the more you can share with each other, the better. So what are some of the challenges that you've experienced? And you don't have to mention any names, but what are some of the challenges that you've experienced where somebody will say, I just want it to be this? You know, I had a situation where a friend of mine told me a story about a director. He was an actor. And he said, my director, the only direction I got was, I want you to be mythical. Do you know how impossible that is for an actor to be mythical? Because who knows what that means, really? It was an adjective. It was a crappy adjective, but it was indeed an adjective. What have you had any of those challenges in the past where it's been like, I don't know how to interpret this?
Sure. From a designer's perspective, it's always, I want the elements to float in space.
So let's defy the laws of physics.
As a builder, everybody wants doors without walls. You know, so there's always these challenges that we want, or the door should be skewed so I don't want the hinges at a right angle.
Then the door doesn't open.
The doors don't work that way, and I'm sorry.
I have to be honest, though. I am guilty of the I want doors without walls, and I did have a designer who gave about as close as I could get. He put them, it required a welder. He basically put them on a heavy metal base plate, and then welded a frame and then put wood around it, but it was still a trip hazard, so.
I do it all the time. It's a tough thing to do. All builders do it. We always talk about it. We always try to figure out a better way to do it. I've used steel, I've used wood, I've used everything you could think of. But directors, and this is to be very kind to them, not to be, you know, negative at all.
Oh, go ahead, be negative. No, I'm kidding.
But they're so caught up in the imaginative where they forget that we do need to ground some of our thoughts in a reality, at least to give us a jumping off point. It's hard for a diver to dive without a springboard. And so once we have that diving board, then we can do things like flips in the air, and then we can do things like land without a splash. But we need the diving board in the water first.
Fantasy isn't fantastic unless you can compare it to reality.
Right. Absolutely.
And it has to exist in reality, too. You know, that's the other thing that all too often, you said, you know, pull the set that the director has out of his head. Well, that's great, except there are no there is no science in his imagination. So you have to deal with the realities of, well, like lighting designers will tell you, I can't bend the light to go around that set piece. It's going to cast a shadow. Audio designers will say, no, I can't put a shutter on the speaker so you only hear it when you're standing here, but not here. I mean, you can, but that it only works for, like, you have to be standing on, like, a little diamond on the floor.
Right.
So, you know, there's always those, what can we do within the realms of science and reality to create that fantasy in our world?
And on the flip side, as a designer, I want the director to tell me everything they would love. We don't have enough time to do all of it. We don't have enough money to do all of it. And we don't have enough resources to do all of it. But directors can sometimes limit themselves from what they know about what's possible. And I don't want a director to have to do that. We might miss a great opportunity because I may have solved that problem 3 years ago or 12 years ago or 15 years ago. And so we may be able to make things happen that you might not have had experience with. And so I want to hear all of that information. And then at the end of the day, we'll worry about, all right, how are we going to pay for it? Where's this manpower? What are we going to strip away now to make it possible? And I tell my students, when you first do a sketch for a design, you have an unlimited amount of money, unlimited amount of time, and an unlimited amount of manpower. Now design. You're going to have to redesign later. But get those ideas down first, because you might be missing out on the best idea of your six ideas if you know that you can't afford it.
Well, and sometimes bad ideas spark really good ideas. You know, you can throw something down. I agree with you. Don't edit yourself. It's the rules of brainstorming. Mm-hmm. The rules of brainstorming. Never negate, never say no. One of my favorite lighting designers, a gentleman by the name of Chris Lau, Chris will tell you, after you finished your lighting design, take away 50% of your cues. You don't have to leave them all gone, but that way you get it down to, here's what's essential. And if you have to add some back, great, but you will more than likely have a much better, much more coherent lighting design without any of the foofy, unnecessary, distracting stuff, because everything you need is there, and then you can go back and add one or two of the other things.
Right, selective focus is important, but we don't have to tell them everywhere to look for every single moment. Audiences are pretty smart. And as a builder, I'm pretty good because I know of thousands of things that don't work. And I've allowed myself to try them first. And eventually, I come up with what does. But it's good to make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah, well, the only thing that actually teaches us is failure. So, you know, we have to make those mistakes in order to, what is it? You don't know what bad music is until you hear bad music. You know, you have to put yourself out there and allow yourself to stumble and fail. So that you can learn from that, and you learn either, well, I shouldn't do that again, or if I do it again, I'm not going to do it that way. That's one I can check off, one way that doesn't work,
right?
And see if I can find another 50 that do.
Right, and maybe it's not even as stark as what works and what doesn't. I did this. This wasn't the most efficient way to do it. There could have been a cleaner way to do it. And so, at the other end of the process, self-critiquing your own work constantly and not thinking that just because it's done, it's good, is super important. It's a hard skill to teach students.
It's a hard skill to teach anyone. It takes actually time and experience to kind of go, it's okay to say this could have been better.
I have never worked on a show that I would not love to revisit and correct. Mm-hmm. Or at least what I think is correction. I can look at anything in my past and see a missed opportunity now that I'm looking at it with fresh eyes. And that doesn't mean that it was a failure as a design or a failure as a production at all. But being able to step away and look, you'll always see something that could have been tweaked just a little bit more or could have been finessed just a little bit more graceful. And it's wonderful to be able to see that in a sort of post-mortem sense of your own stuff. Because it humbles you for the next project. And I love to look for ways to do that, because the more humble I become in what I do, the more honest the actual story is that I'm trying to tell.
Well, and it also, I do believe that the more humble you become, the more honest you are able to become, and the more it is about, each project is about the project or the story, and it's not about you. You know, I'm a huge proponent of people who are confident enough in their work to step out of the way of it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And even fine artists, it is not about them. It is about their canvas or their sculpture or whatever their medium should be. And that's how it should be for us. It's about the story. It's always about the story. It's never about the lead actor. It's never about the classically trained director. It's never about any of us. We are simply the vehicle, because somewhere along the line, someone has deemed this story to be worth telling in a different way. And there's a reason for that in this time and in this place, and we should just all work towards that.
I don't think I could have said that any better ever. So that's perfect. Let's end on a high note. Well, we're going to stop right there. I could talk to you about this all day long, but if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, because obviously they're going to listen to this and go, I like the way this guy thinks, you are based in and around Philly, correct?
Yes.
And if they wanted to get in touch with you to have you design something or work on a project with them, what would be the best way for them to reach out to you?
Right now, the best way would just be email, and it would be CJ Kleckner, that's Kleckner, at iCloud.com.
That's perfect. Well, I can tell you, if you have a project, you'd be foolish not to reach out to Chris and see what he can do for you, because obviously he's approaching this the way so many of my listeners do, and that is from a story-based standpoint and the collaborative effort of any form of theater like we all know that Haunting is. So
and real collaboration, not collaborative with a K.
Collaborative with a K, as in catastrophe. Yeah, with a K. All right, well, thank you so much, Chris. I really do appreciate it, and that's our interview right here from HauntCon.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay, so that brought back a lot of memories from the HauntCon show in New Orleans. And I understand it'll be in New Orleans again. If you've been listening, you probably heard all of my recordings from HauntCon. And by the way, I'm getting ready to go to Transworld, so I will see hopefully some of you there. So anyway, as you can see, different people have different ways of communicating. I think Chris brought up some excellent points, and one of the ones that he brought up was brainstorming. Now, brainstorming is an often forgotten but very important part of any development of a new project, or even polishing of an existing project. And the idea behind brainstorming is pretty much to throw as many ideas out on the table as possible. And I have a friend who refers to it as dating ideas, not marrying them. So the idea is to try to throw out as many cool ideas. Don't throw anything off the table yet. You know, I think Chris used the idea of, you know, don't worry about budget, don't worry about anything else, just put all the ideas out there on the table, because the best one, or the one that sparks the coolest idea, might be the one that is most ridiculously expensive. So, in addition to doing brainstorming with your own team, I think it's important to have tools and resources to help you. Like I said, I'm all about research. And once again, Chris mentioned the importance of research in the interview with him. And one of the tools that I just recently discovered is a relatively new book. Actually, it's not relatively new. It's brand new at the time of this recording. And it is called The Event Brainstormer. And it is by a gentleman by the name of Bob Glickman. It is available on Amazon. So just search The Event Brainstormer. Now, it is a book that is, it just says, keeping your events fresh, engaging, and successful, with over 800 creative concepts and elements for the event professional. This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a book on how to start your brand new event planning and producing business. It's not. What it really is sort of, it's brainstorming in a nutshell. And what Glickman has done is he has put together list upon list upon list of ideas and themes and entertainment options and scenic elements just thrown out there. He puts them in alphabetical order in the book, but just thrown out there to not only polish the ideas that you may have as a brainstormer, but also to spark new ideas for whatever event you happen to be doing. Now, the reason I think this is so important to haunters is we're basically doing an event. You know, doing a haunt is a seasonal festival or event, and the more you can make it unique and different and exciting, the more successful you're going to be. So if you're looking to add something, you may want to sit down and brainstorm and figure out, you know, what can we or should we add? Should we add different kinds of queue entertainment? Should we add different scenic? Can we do a party? Can we do an off-season party that may have a specific theme? I mean, there's all kinds of ideas and opportunities here. And the way this book is laid out, it's I think, incredibly easy to use. It has basically an introduction. It says how to use this book. It then is broken down into overarching event themes. So whether it's anything from time period to a music theme to an athletic theme or whatever. Creative elements, which is then broken down into to scenery and performers and entertainment experiences and ideas for costuming, etc. And finally, technical elements, which is, of course, audio, lighting, video, special effects, that kind of thing. It is not at all, it does not explain to you how Glickman Productions, which is the author's company, it doesn't explain to you at all how his company works. What it does is it basically shares the years and years of his experience, and it's a kind of a, well, just a kind of an encyclopedia of what he has tried and what has worked for him, and it can save you a lot of time and energy, not to mention really spark creative ideas for new events, for new elements, for new parties, whatever. So if you're in the haunt industry, or if you're in the special events industry, you're already a professional events planner or producer, I would strongly recommend picking it up, because it's a great tiny little book. Now, it's funny, because it's not very long. It's only, hang on, let me look at the pages here. It's only about 60-some pages long, and it's paperback, but it is the amount that it will save you in labor to hire on someone to come in and brainstorm with you or facilitate brainstorming is amazing. And in fact, I'm curious to see how it affects Bob's business, because he's one of those kinds of guys that after, you know, over 40 years of producing events, he's pretty much laid all of his ideas out there for everyone else to be inspired by. And so I think that's pretty cool. Take advantage of it if it's something that's helpful for you. Once again, the book is called The Event Brainstormer, and it's by Bob Glickman, and it's available on Amazon. Well, gosh, so that is our episode on communication, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoy all of these, and so until next time, rest in peace.